Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be reached at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the November 6, 2020 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows Uncle Sam. He's standing with his hands on the hip, on his hips. He's looking up at the sky. It's a sunny sky, partly cloudy, bright blue. And he's looking at a road sign. One direction points more Trump, and the other direction points no more Trump. The title is At the Crossroads. Amid the highest turnout in a century, Americans choose between Biden and a second Trump term. And that's our first main story. Trump-Biden battle over swing states. What happened? Donald Trump and Joe Biden made their closing pitches to the nation this week, hitting battleground states as tens of millions of Americans voted early in numbers that promised the highest turnout since 1908. Biden, who holds a commanding lead in national polls and varying advantages in every swing state, hit Republican-leaning states Iowa and Georgia, while Trump played defense, trying to shore up his base with a blitz of rallies in states he won in 2016. The president campaigned in a tone of aggrievement, saying Americans would never choose a female socialist like vice presidential nominee Senator Kamala Harris, and complaining about the media focus on COVID, COVID, COVID. He warned via Twitter of big problems and discrepancies with mail-in ballots, while calling for vote counting to end on election night, which would actually be a departure from the norm. Media organizations traditionally project winners after the polls close, but states have always taken weeks to finalize tallies. On a visit to Georgia, where polls show a dead heat in a state no Democrat has won since 1992, Biden invoked Franklin D. Roosevelt and promised to usher in a new era of national healing and unity. The Bible tells us there is a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to heal, he said. This is that time. Early voters continued to turn out in droves, leading to long waits at many polling places. With a week to go, more than 70 million votes had been cast, more than half the total number of votes in 2016. Early voting leaned strongly Democratic, with high turnouts among African Americans and young people. But Election Day voting is expected to skew heavily Republican. We're clearly headed to record-level turnout nationally and likely in just about every state, said Democratic data analyst Tom Bonnier. Based on polls, the website 538.com gave Biden an 88% chance of winning. As the nation braced for the possibility that no winner will emerge on election night, battle lines were drawn over mail ballots. The Supreme Court ruled that Wisconsin cannot count ballots that arrive after Election Day, regardless of when they were mailed. Justice Brett Kavanaugh appeared to echo Trump in warning of the chaos and suspicions of impropriety that can ensue if late-arriving ballots flip the results. What the editorial said: Now is the moment to bring the sorry Trump saga to an end, said the Los Angeles Times. For 4 years, the nation has been captive to an amoral manipulator who cares for little more than himself and feeding his immense ego. He's wrought incalculable damage to America's standing as an international leader and a defender of human rights. He's badly undermined our democratic institutions, abused his office with unabashed self-dealing, and divided Americans with appeals to racism and xenophobia. Character matters, and Trump has none. Yes, Trump's manner and character inspire strong doubts, said the Washington Examiner. But he is running against a man and, even more, against a party that are deeply flawed and dangerous. Democrats aim to cement themselves in power permanently by abolishing the Senate filibuster, packing the Supreme Court, and tilting the Senate left by granting statehood to Washington, D.C. These schemes threaten the structure of the Republic, and the weak-willed Biden refuses to disavow them. He cannot be trusted with power. What the columnist said. Biden has run a predictable, plodding, unspectacular campaign, said Tim Alberta in Politico.com. But after 4 years of bombast and division, Biden's deficits have become assets. His offer to bring stability, decency, and reconciliation is what much of the electorate seems to want right now. Wisely, he's run a textbook referendum campaign, keeping the spotlight on Trump. Trump needs a miracle to pull this out, but it's not impossible, said Richard North Patterson in TheBulwark.com. Biden could see a fall off in Latino support in critical Florida, Arizona, and North Carolina. Republicans have a big edge in Election Day ground game. And Biden's inartful debate pledge to wean us off oil could hurt in Pennsylvania, a state that may determine the election. If Trump pulls off an upset, said Rich Lowry in National Review, it'll be because he's the only middle finger available to Americans sick of the woke left. Nobody cares about Trump's barely sketched out second-term agenda, but after months of statues toppling, cancel culture run amok, and woke virtue signaling, Americans see a vote for Trump as the only way to strike back at the media, Hollywood, academia, and coastal elites. In the end, it's the pandemic that may bring Trump's reality-denying run to an end, said Eric Levitz in nymag.com. As the numbers of new cases and hospitalizations soar, he seems to think that it's a winning strategy to call a virus that's killed 226,000 Americans fake news, making it clear that he has no interest in containing COVID-19, and that anyone who thinks the raging pandemic is a serious problem should vote for someone else. They will, in droves. What next? As a fraught, divisive campaign nears its finish, police departments across the country are bracing for Election Day, said Mark Berman in the Washington Post. Concerned about voter intimidation, unrest, or violence, departments are running multi-agency planning exercises to try to game out what could happen. A protracted vote count could offer the greatest risk for potential danger, with groups of protesters clashing in the streets. Republican voters' denialism could throw fuel on the fire, said David Atkins in WashingtonMonthly.com. Inside their right-wing media bubble, an astounding 90% of Republican voters believe the polls are wrong and that Trump will win. Meanwhile, Trump has told them the only way he will lose is if Democrats cheat, leaving them extremely unlikely to accept an adverse outcome as legitimate. If Election Day brings an unwelcome shock, it is impossible to predict what might happen. Controversy of the week is titled, The Pandemic. Should we just allow the virus to spread? It took 8 months and more than 230,000 deaths, said Leanna Wynn in the Washington Post. But the White House finally has a plan to combat the coronavirus pandemic. The bad news is that the plan is to accept our fate and surrender to the virus. Even with new daily infections topping 70,000, 29 states reporting record high caseloads, and more than 43,000 patients now hospitalized, White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows last week formally waved the white flag. "We are not going to control the pandemic," Meadows told CNN, explaining that the administration will focus on the search for vaccines, therapeutics, and other mitigations. Meadows didn't use the term herd immunity, but he didn't have to. The idea that we should let the virus rip through our communities until they develop a natural resistance has rapidly gained fans in conservative circles and at the White House, even as scientists warned that it would cost more than 1 million lives. The Trump administration is choosing to meet the greatest public health crisis of our time with a shrug. "What's the alternative?" asked Michael Brendan Daugherty in NationalReview.com. Joe Biden has yet to lay out a plan that differs materially from Trump's. Yes, Biden has his applause lines about promoting face masks, testing, and listening to scientists. But masks and testing are already available. So Biden is just offering Trump's plan with a different rhetorical emphasis. "Calling the herd immunity approach surrender is also unfair," said Faye Flam in Bloomberg.com. "The core of the strategy is to encourage younger people to go on with life while protecting those over 60, who are 1,000 times likelier to die of COVID-19 than the under 30s. Eradicating viral spread, which has been the strategy of small, isolated countries like New Zealand, is extremely unlikely to work in a country the size of the U.S. The sane alternative to surrendering is for everyone to wear face masks in public," said Apurva Mandavia in the New York Times. "A new University of Washington study warns that we're on course to suffer 511,000 deaths by March 1st, but that we could save 129,574 lives if 95% of the population would only wear face masks. The current rate is just under half." "The data on masks is increasingly clear," said Scott Gottlieb in the Wall Street Journal. "A study from the University of Kansas showed infections in that state rose twice as fast in counties that resisted the governor's mask mandate as in those that complied. Mask wearing isn't a political issue. It's the cheapest, easiest step we can take as a nation to weather a difficult winter." "It's not going to happen under Trump," said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. In the campaign's final week, he was jetting from rally to rally, maskless as usual, lying to maskless supporters that doctors are lying about death tolls and that the U.S. has rounded the turn. It's abundantly clear Trump will do nothing at all to fight the pandemic for however long he remains in office. "Trump may have surrendered," said Jeffrey Sachs in CNN.com. "But the overwhelming majority of Americans have not. With the pandemic's dreaded fall wave now upon us, let's do what we know we need to do. Socially distance, wear masks, get tested. Until vaccines arrive, it's our only way to save our parents, siblings, children, friends, and fellow Americans from a killer disease that not only claims lives, but can lead to long-term grave disabilities." We're on the Good Week, Bad Week segment. Seems it was a good week for privilege after Kim Kardashian West informed her 190 million Instagram followers that to celebrate her 40th birthday, she surprised my closest inner circle with a trip to a private island where we could pretend things were normal just for a brief moment in time. It was a good week for owning it with news that Kazakhstan is formally adopting "very nice" as its tourism slogan. "Very nice" is a catchphrase of Borat Sadegeev, Sacha Baron Cohen's fictional Kazakh journalist, who portrays the country as backward and filled with anti-Semites. And it was a good week for the Los Angeles Dodgers, who won the World Series after the strangest baseball season in history. Shortened to 60 regular season games by the pandemic, with players being tested daily for the coronavirus. But it was a bad week for social distancing. After Dodgers third baseman Justin Turner was pulled from the field in the series finale when his COVID test came back positive. Later, a maskless Turner rushed out to the field to celebrate with his teammates and their families. A super spreader event on live TV, as one MLB general manager put it. It was a bad week for privilege. After White House senior advisor and real estate heir Jared Kushner said on Fox News, many black people don't want to be successful, which explains why they stay mired in all the problems that they're complaining about. And finally, it was a bad week for Santa Claus. After the Trump administration scrapped a plan to give Santa Claus performers early access to any coronavirus vaccines. This was our greatest hope for Christmas 2020, said Rick Irwin, chairman of the Fraternal Order of Real Bearded Santas. Short news piece before we go on. New evidence of election hacking. U.S. intelligence agencies warned last week that Russia and Iran have both obtained American voter registration records and are trying to influence public opinion ahead of the November 3rd election. The FBI said Russia hacked dozens of state and local government servers over the past month and stole data from two. The Bureau added that while no data seems to have been altered, the attacks posed some risk to state and local election data. The Iranian effort was said to include sending emails that purported to come from the right-wing Proud Boys and threatened Democrats with harm if they did not vote for President Trump. Director of National Intelligence John Ratcliffe said the emails were intended to hurt Trump, a claim that elicited fierce skepticism from Democrats. We're on the briefing page. The title this week is Controlling the Supreme Court. This isn't the first time an aggrieved political party has sought to add or subtract justices. Why are there nine justices? It's the product of the court's historical evolution and several bitter political struggles. In the Constitution, the Founding Fathers established the court as a third branch of government to settle cases or controversies, but offered no details about its size. They left that determination to Congress, which set the initial template with the Judiciary Act of 1789, signed into law by George Washington. It called for six justices who would serve until they retired or died. The act created 13 judicial districts divided into three circuits, and Supreme Court justices were required to do double duty, traveling or riding circuit twice a year to serve as circuit court judges. Each circuit was assigned two justices. A growing number of circuits would affect the size of the court over time, but so would political maneuvering, which surfaced almost immediately with Washington's successor, John Adams. What did Adams do? In 1800, Adams, a Federalist, lost a re-election bid to Thomas Jefferson, a Democratic Republican, a party opposed to centralized power in Washington. That December, the Chief Justice resigned due to illness, creating an 11th-hour opening that Federalists were eager to fill. Sound familiar? In a lame duck session that extended into March, Adams nominated and Congress confirmed a replacement, John Marshall, a Federalist lawyer and politician. Congress also reduced the court size to five to deprive Jefferson of a pick if a seat were vacated. The move ultimately had no effect, as the new Congress quickly repealed the act. And during Jefferson's second term in 1807, Congress added a seventh circuit and thus a seventh justice. The court expanded again in 1837 when two more circuits were created, allowing President Andrew Jackson to add two justices. That brought the total to nine, where it stayed until the Civil War. Marshall, the Justice Adams shoehorned onto the bench, would serve for 34 years and become one of the court's most influential justices. In the landmark Marbury v. Madison decision, he established the principle of judicial review, giving the court the power to nullify laws if believed violate the Constitution. What changes did the Civil War bring? The first was executed by Abraham Lincoln, who wanted to establish an anti-slavery majority on the court, which was dominated by Democrat-appointed Southerners. He was especially appalled by the 1857 Dred Scott decision, which held that blacks were so far inferior that they had no rights, which the white man was bound to respect. In 1863, the Republican Congress created a 10th Circuit in California to allow Lincoln to add a 10th justice to the court. After Lincoln was assassinated and Andrew Johnson, a Unionist Democrat who opposed civil rights protections for newly freed slaves, took office, the court shifted again. To limit Johnson's reach and prevent him from filling a fresh vacancy, Congress in 1866 cut the number of justices back to seven. That lasted just 3 years until 1869, when the last court alteration was made. What happened in 1869? The shift was, again, politically motivated. Ulysses Grant was elected in 1868 with the backing of congressional Republicans, who decided that with Grant in power, the court could use a couple of additional justices after all. They returned the number to nine, and Grant nominated two candidates who believed in the validity of paper money, just in time to reverse a previous 4-3 Supreme Court ruling that paper money, not backed by gold or silver, was unconstitutional. The enlarged court averted a crisis for the nation's monetary system, but not everyone was thrilled. This attempt to pack the Supreme Court to secure a desired judicial decision, thundered the Daily Argus of Illinois, has brought shame and humiliation. It would be 60 years before another president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, tried to change the court's size. What was Roosevelt's motivation? The New Deal initiatives Roosevelt launched to pull the U.S. out of the Great Depression faced strong resistance in a conservative-leading Supreme Court, which struck down a number of its key provisions. In 1937, FDR proposed a plan to add six justices to the court, one for each justice over 70. The move would bring an infusion of new blood, said Roosevelt, who vowed to appoint justices who will act as justices and not as legislators. The proposal was roundly criticized, and not just by Republicans. Even Roosevelt's vice president opposed it, and Senate voted 70-20 against it. Roosevelt badly miscalculated reverence for the court and its independence, said University of Virginia presidential scholar Barbara Perry. But his threat to remake the court had an apparent impact on its rulings, which became more favorable to FDR's initiatives. The court's about-face was summed up by a contemporary humorist who called it the switch in time that saved nine. Proposals for reform. Should Supreme Court justices serve for life? Reformers have long pointed out that the expected lifespan of justices has lengthened by several decades since the 18th century, with many modern justices occupying their powerful perch for more than 30 years. The most oft-proposed plan would have justices serve staggered 18-year terms that would create a vacancy every 2 years, or two per presidential term. A 2019 poll by Marquette University Law School suggested such a shift would be an easier sell than court packing. While 57% opposed the latter, 72% favored term limits. More elaborate dangers in the court's makeup have been proposed. Under one plan, put forth in 2018 Yale Law Journal article, all federal appellate court judges would become associate justices. Panels of nine would be selected randomly and rotate regularly. Another proposal, backed by Pete Buttigieg in his Democratic primary bid, would expand the court to 15 justices. Five would be allocated to each party, while those 10 would choose an additional five. "We can't go on like this," Buttigieg said, "where every single time there's a vacancy, we have this apocalyptic ideological firefight about what to do next." Time for a few of the columns. We'll start with senators who no longer love Trump. With Election Day looming, some GOP senators are scrambling to get as far away from President Trump as possible, said Renee Graham. For the past 4 years, Republicans in Congress have competed for the title of Trump's most loyal cheerleader. Now vulnerable Republicans are socially distancing from Trump. Senator John Cornyn of Texas, long a steadfast Trump man, now claims he privately disagreed with some of Trump's policies, comparing his relationship with the president to women who get married and think they're going to change their spouse, and that doesn't usually work out very well. Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska delivered a withering assessment of the president to supporters, saying Trump kisses dictators' butts, mocks evangelical Christians, and flirted with white supremacists. Senator Martha McSally of Arizona, trailing in her race, no longer allies herself with Trump, saying instead that she's fighting for Arizonans. Republicans silently acquiesced when Trump allowed migrant children to be locked in cages, mocked troops, coddled racists, and sabotaged the pandemic response. His policies badly damaged the GOP brand, and Republicans now see their 53-47 Senate majority slipping away. It's a little late for courage, isn't it? This is from Poland, why the abortion ban came now. The Polish government is willing to torture vulnerable women to keep the Catholic Church on its side, said Michalina Kobla. Our nation's top court last week ruled that aborting a fetus with severe fetal abnormalities was unconstitutional, effectively banning all terminations in a country that already has some of the strictest abortion laws in Europe. This decision has nothing to do with actual protection of life, since these fetuses die shortly after birth. All it does is force poor women who can't go abroad for abortions to bear these doomed infants whose lives, spanning a few hours, will be an unimaginable torment. The decision wasn't sparked by a court case. A group of conservative lawmakers asked for a review of current law, knowing that the Constitutional Court, which the government has packed with political appointees, would do its bidding. Why now? Because the government needed to placate the Catholic Church. The ruling Law and Justice Party, in a bid to appeal to young voters, recently announced a ban on the fur trade, angering key church leaders, who said that fetuses were more important than animals and that the government should focus on abortion. The governing coalition almost fell apart over the issue. Now the government is stable, but at what cost? And this is from Argentina. Why we're buying up everything. Argentines are on a spending spree, said Laura Garcia. With our country's history of sky-high inflation and repeated defaults on sovereign debt, we have had to become experts at ridding ourselves of worthless currency. We just start buying things in the knowledge that material objects at least have intrinsic worth. That's why when the pandemic began, we stockpiled food, medicine, and cleaning products with a fervor unrivaled by people in most other countries that underwent lockdowns. And unlike them, we're still stockpiling. The Argentine peso is once again on the road to devaluation, so we're trading our pesos for spare materials for our pandemic bunkers. property in the country to escape from urban lockdowns, and imported articles of all kinds, even whiskey. Construction supplies are a logical choice because any home improvements done now ought to make our homes worth more in dollar terms when prices eventually stabilize. Similarly, it makes sense to nab anything imported. Argentines are snapping up refrigerators, stereos, TVs, whatever is non-perishable and can someday be resold. Buy it today goes the thinking, because tomorrow it may be more expensive or unavailable. To be Argentine is to have a master's degree in exploiting windows of opportunity. We're on to the last word, our long article this week titled "An Election with Forebodings of Doom." A rule of thumb in politics used to be that optimism wins, said Mark Fisher in the Washington Post. Now many Americans are consumed with fear that the apocalypse will come if the other side prevails. A psychiatrist examining what's happened to America's soul chooses for his book cover the iconic image from Planet of the Apes, a charred, half-buried wreck of the Statue of Liberty. A minister who believes America is God's chosen nation decides that a Joe Biden victory would mean doom, a crushing of the nation's essence. And a filmmaker whose work has celebrated the raucous mess of American politics concludes that the re-election of President Donald Trump would be the end of democracy. Just days before Americans choose their path forward, the quadrennial crossroads reeks of despair. In almost every generation, politicians pose certain elections as the most important of their time. But the 2020 vote takes place with the country in a historically dark mood, low on hope, running on spiritual empty, convinced that the wrong outcome will bring disaster. "I've never seen anything like it," said Frank Luntz, a Republican political consultant who has been convening focus groups of undecided voters for 7 presidential cycles. "Even the most balanced mainstream people are talking about this election in language that is more caffeinated and cataclysmic than anything I've ever heard. If you are a believer in climate change, re-electing Trump is literally the end of the world. If taxes are your issue, you think a Biden victory will bankrupt you. If your top concern is health care, you think a Biden loss will kill you." There's a long history of lurid foreboding in American politics. Among the nation's founders were pamphleteers who made their names decrying the dire future the colonists faced if their revolution failed. But the current language is so apocalyptic that even those who are steeped in the country's episodes of extreme rhetoric are alarmed. The worry on the right that a Democratic win will plunge the nation into catastrophic socialism, and the fear on the left that a Trump victory will produce a turn toward totalitarianism, have created a perilous moment. The idea that if the other side wins, we're in for it, said Peter Stearns, a history of emotions at George Mason University. The two sides have come to view each other not as opponents, but as deeply evil, he said. And that's happening when trust in institutions has collapsed and each group is choosing not to live near each other. It seems there's no middle ground. Americans are especially susceptible to a dark, pessimistic view of the country now because several powerful forces are undermining institutions that people have trusted for centuries, according to scholars who have studied the shift in popular attitudes. Start with a populist president with a showman's predilection for apocalyptic language. Then there's the flowering of unfounded beliefs. the QAnon conspiracy theory about a deep state elite that secretly controls the government, fake news, fear of rampaging immigrants. Meanwhile, a revolution in technology and media has dramatically altered how Americans consume news and learn about politics. Add a frightening pandemic, a burst of protest and anger over racial inequalities, and a sudden economic collapse, and the result is pervasive mistrust, a sense that the world's most powerful nation can no longer come together in common cause. In sharp contrast with other presidents, Trump has positioned himself not as a unifying ambassador of hope, but as a fellow victim. He tweets conspiracy theories, broods over hoaxes aimed at him, and campaigns for re-election as a breakwater against anarchy in the streets and a nefarious plot against the suburbs. For many years, a rule of thumb in American politics was that the candidate with the sunnier outlook was likely to win. The other presidents elected in the past 3 decades appealed to American optimism and aspirations. Bill Clinton ran as the man from hope. George W. Bush presented himself as a compassionate conservative. Barack Obama centered his campaign on hope and change. Biden this month warned that the country is in a dangerous place. Our trust is in each other is ebbing. Hope seems elusive. Too many Americans see our public life as an occasion for total, unrelenting partisan warfare. For his part, Trump argues that the country will collapse into mob rule if Biden wins. No one will be safe, the president said. Frank Amedia's America is on the edge of the abyss, a place where people of faith expect Armageddon and people on the other side conspire to scrap freedoms. TV evangelist Pat Robertson announced on his show last week that there's going to be a war after the election. Robertson prophesied that America will experience civil unrest of great proportions, then a time of peace, then maybe the end. Not to be outdone, Amedia, pastor of Touch Heaven Ministries in Canfield, Ohio, and a former advisor to the Trump campaign on Christian policy, delivered his own vision of what the country will face if Biden wins. Progressive Marxist socialism, lawlessness, even an embrace of animalism. Somebody can marry a cow and have perverse sex with them. On camera, Amedia, who hosts Poachers Shield, a YouTube series devoted to praise of the president, predicts an apocalyptic future if Trump loses, a time of secular riots and biblical upheaval. But off camera, the preacher seems more anguished than angry, more searching than seething. Both sides agree that the soul of the nation is at stake, he said in an interview. I know that other nations faltered by becoming divisive, amoral, totally based on personal ambitions and agendas. We seem to be there. Amedia believes Trump was chosen by God to lead the United States, but he has no illusion that the president is an admirable character. Amedia laments the sad political discourse in the country that has developed into a win-at-almost-any-cost mentality. How did we end up with Joe Biden and Donald Trump? We're supposed to have certain ideals, and I don't think either of them musters up to it. Why are some people joining into causes and movements? Why are they finding some credence in things like QAnon, Amedia asked. They're trying to fill a void. In this season of anxiety, people want something that's beyond this feeling of loss of control. Our house is out of control. Our presidency, our Congress, the virus. People want leadership that's fair and open. Why must we choose between right and left? Why can't we be both for both black justice and right to life? Why can't we accept the science and the faith? The pastor plans to continue his Poachers Shield prayers for the president, whether Trump or Biden wins. That's what we're supposed to do as Americans, he said. In my church, we accept the results, whatever they are, and we're going to be the voice that brings the unity. Sometimes when things have gotten a little too easy, people need to get put into a little bit of a pressure cooker to discover what their real values are. Maybe that's where we are. How can we heal the wound with respect for each other? 4 years ago, R.J. Cutler, a documentary filmmaker who focused on American political culture in The War Room and A Perfect Candidate, said that the country was heading into a time when any bad thing seemed possible, when we no longer know the ground rules about the weather, about democracy, about very basic things. The reality of Trump's presidency has been worse than he anticipated, Cutler says now, and he is certain that a second term would be a disaster. I'm one of those people that believes it's the end of democracy and we're in for a totalitarian state, he said. Trump wants his cultural enemies silenced. He wants to control communication. The culture will fight back, but this guy's going to put people in prison. To quote my mother, good luck to us. Cutler, who has devoted recent years to making movies about the lives of Saturday Night Live pioneer John Belushi and pop singer Billie Eilish, remains hopeful that if Biden wins, you're going to see a cultural rebound, a time of creativity, of searching for solutions to long-festering problems. But even if his side wins, Cutler says, it's hard to imagine that the country would simply turn a corner and start fresh. We've become a stratified culture. There's no longer one truth. I mean, there are people who think California's on fire because we haven't swept the ground. A post-Trump period could be a political and cultural free-for-all, Cutler said, in which some Americans, finally freed from coronavirus restrictions, might fall into a time of hedonism while others remain fixated on social divisions that will not disappear quickly. Just because Trump goes away, if he really goes away, the forces he unleashed and the forces that arose in response don't go away. When Thomas Singer, a psychiatrist in San Francisco, was casting around for a cover picture for his book on what has happened to the soul of America, his view of the country had grown dire. Things were falling apart, he said. Our inner experience as individuals or groups on the left or the right is that there's something very damaged about everything that makes us American. We're shattered. He stumbled on the famous image at the end of the original 1968 version of Planet of the Apes. The harrowing discovery of the ruined Statue of Liberty sunken into a beach, a haunting symbol of a nation that lost its ideals and collapsed. Sometimes art anticipates reality, Singer said. This was an apocalyptic sense that democracy as we know it will crumble. But in the time between choosing that image and publishing the book, Singer came to a different conclusion about America in the time of Trump. The psychiatrist, who is 78, recalls the anguish that the divided country went through in 1968. This sense that everything was coming apart. Yet, as a young man, he said, he and his peers never believed their future was doomed. Now, however, he hears young people lament that they have no path forward, that the earth is in fatal decline, that new technologies threaten the future of work. Though many of these forces contributing to that despair were at work before Trump came along, Singer sees the president as an engine of mistrust. He has contributed enormously to this sense that we can't agree on what's real anymore, he said. He thrives on chaos. He is profoundly rebellious, and that goes to the absolute core of American identity. That idea of Trump as a quintessentially American renegade, one in a series of rebels without a cause, has nudged Singer toward the view that the president is not simply a destructive force or, as Trump sees himself, a disruptor. Rather, the psychiatrist says, Trump, perhaps unwittingly, is giving the country another chance to do what it has always done best, to battle and rage in what the poet Walt Whitman called America's essential characteristic, a barbaric yawp of conflict that breeds innovation and renewal. The soul of the nation gets forged in that collision of ideas about race, about money and capitalism, about the individual versus the collective, Singer said. Populist surges like the one that helped Trump win in 2016, fueled by the exasperation of Americans who believe that neither party addressed lost jobs, diminished communities, and emptied malls and downtowns, have burned out within a few years, fading away as economic expansion, war, or political reform eased people's insecurities. Singer believes a second Trump term would further undermine trust and social cohesion, but now he wonders if the president may have forced the country to confront and maybe resolve some of its deepest problems. A leader, like a parent, sets a model for behavior, Singer said. Biden is a return to deeply cherished American values of decency and goodwill. Trump has flushed out all of our raw divisions. I'm hopeful that people will find their unruly and chaotic American soul and cry out. The result may be profoundly renewing about race, climate, maybe health care. Ultimately, Trump may serve a valuable purpose, he said. In the human experience, death and rebirth go together. A version of this story originally appeared in the Washington Post. Here's a short science piece. A secret organ in your head. If you thought centuries of surgery and study had revealed all the mysteries of human anatomy, think again. Researchers in the Netherlands say that while scanning prostate and urethral gland cancer patients, they inadvertently discovered a new organ in the nook where the nasal cavity meets the throat, a pair of large saliva glands. They examined at least 100 patients to confirm their suspicion and found the mystery organs, which they have named tubarial glands, in every one, reports independent.co.uk. If confirmed, it would be the first discovery of its kind for about 300 years. The researchers say the organ likely moistens the upper part of the throat and may explain why people undergoing radiation therapy for cancer often experience chronic dry mouth or issues with swallowing. Doctors try to avoid zapping salivary glands during radiation therapy for this very reason. Tubarial glands have probably remained hidden all these years because of their location, says study author Wouter Vogel from his Netherlands Cancer Institute. It is not very accessible, and you need very sensitive imaging to detect it. And we'll turn on over to the Talking Points page and start with an article titled, Civil Servants, the Coming Trump Purge. President Trump is paving the way for mass firings of career civil servants if he wins a second term, said Laurie Garrett in CNN.com. Last week, Trump signed an executive order fit for a banana republic, reclassifying more than 100,000 federal employees involved in policymaking so they can be fired without cause, like political appointees. That change, set to take effect on the eve of January's presidential inauguration, would let Trump get rid of scientists, medical experts, foreign policy experts, and regulators of all kinds, and pack the federal workforce with partisan sycophants and stooges. A leader of the largest federal worker union called it a declaration of war, and Ronald Sanders, a Trump-appointed head of a council on civil service, resigned in protest. This is just part of Trump's second-term hit list, said Jonathan Swan and Elena Treen in Axios.com. Sources who've spoken to Trump say he plans to fire FBI Director Christopher Wray, CIA Director Gina Haspel, Defense Secretary Mark Esper, and all other agency and department heads who've resisted his demands. Trump claims he wants to weed out underperformers, said Bruce Lee in Forbes.com. But there's a reason even the president can't fire federal employees indiscriminately. Take Dr. Anthony Fauci, who served as director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases since 1984, a tenure spanning three Republican and two Democratic administrations. Career public servants like Fauci carry specialized knowledge across presidencies, but Trump isn't interested in evidence-based scientific, economic, or military advice. He wants to stock critical federal agencies with yes people. This order is a dramatic escalation of Trump's authoritarianism, said Matt Ford in NewRepublic.com. He believes the federal government should operate like the Trump Organization, with every employee serving the boss's whims and political interest. In Trump's first term, said Bess Levin in VanityFair.com, he was bedeviled by rules barring him from axing federal employees who encouraged mask wearing during the pandemic, or highlighted the threat of climate change, or refused to back up his erroneous claim that a hurricane was headed for Alabama. Even if Trump loses the election, he might use his order to go on a firing spree and cripple a Joe Biden administration for months. That would be petty, destructive, and vengeful, but would anyone be surprised? Pope Francis: gays deserve families too. Pope Francis' endorsement of civil unions is a big deal, said Michael Mago in the Los Angeles Times. In a new documentary, Francis says gay people are children of God and have the right to be in a family. He adds, you can't kick someone out of a family nor make their life miserable. What we have to have is a civil union law. That way, they are legally protected. His sympathetic comments, though not official church policy, represent a sharp departure from the Vatican's official position that treating gay people with love and respect should not be misconstrued as approval of homosexual behavior or legal recognition of homosexual unions. Francis is sending a message of tolerance to conservative Catholic parishes that fire gay staff because they get married, and to Catholic social service organizations that refuse to place foster kids with same-sex couples. Actually, Francis' position is not new, at least not for him, said Joshua McAwee, a National Catholic reporter. He's endorsed civil unions at least twice as a way to differentiate between Catholic marriage and relationships recognized by state authorities. And in 2010, as Cardinal Jorge Bergoglio of Buenos Aires, he supported civil unions in Argentina. Once again, Francis is toying with church teaching, said George Neumayer in Spectator.org. A permissive pope for a permissive age, he leaves the church in a state of pitiful confusion with his frequent liberal pronouncements that make him sound like a politician seeking applause, not a spiritual leader. Despite Francis' sentiments, LGBTQ Catholics shouldn't expect much change, said Celia Vago Wexler in NBCNews.com. Catholic schools won't start allowing gay people to teach or the children of gay couples to attend. Francis has several times raised Catholics' progressive hopes with his impromptu remark, only to backtrack when traditionalists howled. As a gay Catholic who has accepted the church's teaching of chastity, I am desperate for encouragement, said Eve Tushnet in the Washington Post. But anyone who sees Francis' words as a step toward approval of gay sex or marriage will be disappointed. He's defined the family as a man, woman, and children, and evoked the argument as late as 2016 that there are absolutely no grounds for considering homosexual unions to be even remotely analogous to God's plan for marriage and family. He hasn't yet said what I so want to hear, but one day I hope he will. And we'll read a few of the short notes, starting with undergraduate enrollment at American universities and colleges has fallen 4% across the board and 16% among freshmen this semester. the pandemic will cost these institutions an estimated $120 billion, and many are laying off faculty and staff. In all 214,000 cases and 75 deaths, mostly among adults, have been reported on U.S. campuses since the spring. One out of five U.S. corporations that reported profits of $100 million or more in 2019 either paid zero in federal taxes or negative taxes, with the government refunding them more money than they paid. 52% of U.S. adults ages 18 to 29 are now living at home with their parents. Many moved back after losing jobs during the pandemic. On the poll watch, 61% of U.S. adults now say they know someone who has had COVID-19, up from 10% in late March and 41% in mid-July. 22% know someone who died of COVID-19. And we'll finish with a quote from author Edith Wharton, who says, "There are lots of ways of being miserable, but there's only one way of being comfortable, and that is to stop running around after happiness." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.